We'll hear arguments first this morning in Mobile Oil Corporation against Commissioner of Taxes of Vermont. Mr. Hellerstein, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this is an appeal by Mobile Oil Corporation from a decision of the Vermont Supreme Court holding the dividends received by Mobil from its subsidiaries and affiliates, which operated exclusively in foreign countries and derived virtually all their income from sources outside the United States, that such dividends were properly includable in the apportionable base of the Vermont tax. That's the only issue in the case. Now, the facts are these. Mobil is a New York corporation. Its corporate headquarters and commercial domicile are located in New York City. It's engaged in all aspects of the petroleum business, including exploration, production of oil and gas, refining, transportation, and sale of petroleum product. Now, the only activities carried on in Vermont consisted of the wholesale and retail marketing of product. Mobil is subject to taxes measured by net income, not only in the state of Vermont, but in 40 other states, as well as the District of Columbia. The company is engaged in both interstate and foreign commerce. Now, with respect to these stocks, Mobil owned the stocks of a large number of corporations, subsidiaries and affiliates, and as I've said, they carried on their business solely in foreign countries. These dividends that are here in issue constituted most of Mobil's taxable income. Now, 99% of the dividends were received from corporations that derived all or all except a very insignificant portion of their income from sources outside the United States. Mobil's business as the owner of these stocks was in all respects conducted outside Vermont, managed, directed offices outside Vermont. The same is true of the dividends, the receipt of the dividends, and the disposition of the dividends.
Mr. Hillard, yes, sir. How large a tax would Mobil have paid in Vermont under your theory and under the return that it filed?
Under the theory we are presenting, something like $4,000 for the 3 years. Now, I'd like to go to that, Your Honor, because the Commissioner has suggested that a tax of $4,000 for this great multinational company can hardly be a fair representation of what Mobil ought to pay for the activities carried on in the state. But I think we ought to remember several things. The Vermont legislature imposed an income tax, and when the Vermont legislature imposed that income tax, it knew perfectly well that that might result in a loss, even though we have a lot of property and assets in the state. The commissioner, in making this very argument, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that you're making $4,000 for this gargantuan company.
I thought it was a question rather than an argument that I was making.
No, there's no question about it. It's a small amount. The other point I want to make is that's what the Vermont legislature decided was a fair payment of the income tax. But this isn't the only tax we pay in Vermont. We're subject to other taxes, property taxes, sales taxes, highway use taxes, and whatnot. So the smallness of this amount really reflects the fact that Mobil's income is earned from dividends that are all outside Vermont for all practical purposes.
Were those dividends taxed other than by the federal government?
That raises the question, were those dividends taxed by any other state?
That isn't what I asked. I said, where were they taxed?
Where were they taxed?
Where were they taxed? Outside.
By no state.
In
Let
no
me
state.
Explain why. They were taxed. The state of New York, which is the commercial domicile of Mobil, has a policy of not taxing dividends from subsidiaries at all. With respect to non-subsidiaries, it reverts the tax, takes the percentage of the tax as to where the income was earned. So with respect to these dividends, we paid little or no tax. But now, Your Honor, Mr. Justice Blackmun, that gets to a key question in the case.
Let me ask another question. Am I correct? Under the Vermont system, is there not a statutory provision that enables a taxpayer to seek a reallocation in the event of unfairness? Did Mobil take advantage of that?
And it was denied. Right. Now, I want to go to the question Mr. Justice Blackmun raised, because it's one of the key questions in the case. When we come to the Commerce Clause argument, in which we contend that we ought not, that the apportioned tax by a state, by Vermont, in which we carry on no aspect of the of these operations, that none of those, no state in which we carry on our operating functions is distinguished from the management of our interest in the stocks, that none of those states ought to be able to apportion that income because you would have a risk of multiple taxation. Either the risk of possible double taxation as a result of the taxing power of the commercial domicile or business situs, if that was the state, plus the apportioned tax, or, given just the apportionment, the risk of diversity of taxation. Now, I want to go to first this question that Mr. Justice Blackmun has raised. The doctrine, as Your Honors will recall, is well established. The multiple taxation doctrine, clearly, as developed by its architects, who were Justices Stone and Justice Rutledge, later extended by other justices of the court. There isn't any question but that that doctrine depended on the following proposition. Do other states have the power to tax, regardless of whether they exercise it? That's clear. Everybody recognized that. However, counsel say subsequent opinions of this court have modified the doctrine so that the multiple taxation doctrine doesn't prevent a tax on interstate or foreign commerce unless you prove you've actually been double taxed by another state. First of all, an analysis of the cases does not support the view that that doctrine has been abandoned. But authority aside, I want to go to the reasons why it should not be abandoned by this court. And there are two sets of reasons, Your Honors. One are pragmatic, and one are matters of constitutional principle. First, as to the pragmatic objections to the actual multiple taxation test. Such a test would foster a competitive race among state legislatures and tax departments, too, to be the first to tax and the first to assess. Moreover, inequalities between corporations earning the same amount of income within a state would be fostered. Why? The taxes could be different under the actual multiple taxation test because of taxes that different taxes than each of them pay in other states. As a matter of constitutional principle, I suggest that likewise dictates the retention of the power to tax. What are we dealing with?
Are you saying that only New York could tax these?
Sir?
Are you saying that only New York could tax?
Our contention is this, Your Honor, that given a situation in which all the operations of the company, vis-a-vis the management of the stocks, the receipt and disposition of the dividends, when all of those take place outside a state, typically it would be the commercial domicile, our contention is this. One, historically, the tradition of state taxation was to allocate those in full to the commercial domicile. Two, that's the right rule. Why is it the right rule? Your process of law.
Well, you are saying then that only New York can.
That is correct.
Well, then doesn't that lead to the same sort of competitiveness in order to get the advantage of corporate presence and activity in the state, like Delaware used to have in corporate charters, that the state with the lowest income tax rate for investment income earned out of the country is going to be a haven for corporate domiciles?
Your Honor, I think there's a fundamental difference. The federal constitution has never interfered with the states working out their own policies to attract business or to make life livable. That's a choice that every state has and should have, including the charting of its tax policies. But Mr. Justice Rehnquist, it's very different to say one state's power of tax is going to be increased or decreased because what another state does. Each of the states can use its own policy reasons for attracting trade, whether it's for energy purposes or whether it's to make management as central. But that's the substance of our federal constitutional system.
Mr. Hellerstein, suppose you didn't have these subsidiaries.
Right.
And the income flowed in to the taxpayer, Mobil.
Right.
Would you be here today?
We would not be here on this case. The reason I have to say that is we might be here on a later case. But this likewise gets to one of the gut problems in the case. The whole pitch, really, of the argument on the other side is this. This runs through all their briefs, including the numerous briefs signed by their and my side. They say Mobile and its foreign subsidiaries and the foreign affiliates from which we receive dividends, they're really all part of one unitary international petroleum business. And so it doesn't matter that these stocks were not handled. No part of the handling of the stocks are taken care of in the state of Vermont. We can look at the whole system and we can take into account the fact that what goes on in the Middle East and the digging for oil has some bearing on the international petroleum business, including, let's say, the marketing of oil in Vermont. That is one of the methods that a state may employ. There are some limitations. You have to avoid distortions. You have to have a unitary business. But if Vermont had treated Mobil and its subsidiaries and affiliates as a unitary business and had used what is known as the combined method of reporting, what would have happened would have been this. The base of the tax would be all the income of all these companies in the unitary business worldwide. The apportionment factors, property, payroll, receipts that determine the fraction that this state taxes, would be of all those companies. In those circumstances, we wouldn't have this problem, but there would be a different problem if there as to the propriety of that. But that isn't our case. But that is a well-recognized method. Vermont doesn't...
You're objecting here at the very outset of even including in the base this dividend income.
What I'm saying, Mr. Justice White, is this. Vermont doesn't use that combined method. Vermont uses the separate company method. Vermont doesn't treat the companies as a unitary business, else there wouldn't be any dividends to tax. That if you're going to treat the company, Mobil, as a separate company, taking into account only Mobil's own income and only Mobil's own factors and giving no credit to the fact that these hundreds of millions of dollars of dividends were earned entirely outside the state, that the stocks were managed outside the state, if you're going to, you can't have apples and oranges. They're conflicting methods. If you want to tax our dividends, you got to tax us as the owner of stocks and the holder of these dividends, and nothing took place in Vermont with respect to them.
Would you make the same, are you making the same argument, or would you, with respect to dividend income from United States subsidiaries? Say Mobil does all its business in Alaska through a subsidiary.
We are making... The same arguments would apply under our due process contention. The same arguments would not apply under our Foreign Commerce Clause contention. That is, if we were dealing here with domestic dividends, our due process arguments would be applicable. But when we get over to the Commerce Clause...
Well, we have a domestic commerce, you know. We have an interstate commerce.
Right. We don't have any domestic dividends here. This is all from foreign commerce.
I know, but some other people, I know you don't. But
suppose we had that case, Your Honor's asking.
Well,
then I am saying...
Your argument would certainly apply to domestic subsidiaries.
The due process argument, yes.
Well, and why wouldn't the commerce argument?
Because...
You have an interstate commerce clause.
We are... The due process argument, the reason why we are not arguing that the dividends received, if they were here, the dividends received from domestic subsidiaries... are not apportionable is this. There is a problem as to whether the Mormon case precludes that contention. Mm-hmm. We would argue it is not. If you get to the Commerce Clause argument, Mr. Justice White, as distinguished from the due process argument, when you get to the Commerce Clause argument, we've got the problem that Mormon took the position with respect to domestic commerce, that is interstate commerce, that the court would not intervene in methods of apportionment. We argue it's a jurisdictional problem, due process. But if that's rejected and you get to the problem that this is something that involves a right of apportionment, then Mormon says this court will not intervene when interstate commerce is involved.
Well,
but
Japan
line... I'm sorry, Mr. Justice Rehnquist.
Just following up Justice White's question, isn't it precisely the same clause of the Constitution that Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes that you derive your argument from? So if it's good for foreign commerce, it must be good for interstate commerce.
Mr. Justice Rehnquist, we here have the benefit of a decision of the majority of the court in Japan Line, which says foreign commerce is different. Foreign commerce is more sensitive. The majority of that court, whatever else you may say about Japan Line, in which I'm aware Your Honor dissented, whatever else you may say about Japan Line, it established two things that are the crux of this case, vis-a-vis the foreign commerce clause problem, Mr. Justice White, as distinguished from the interstate clause. Those are two things that are established. One, foreign commerce is much more sensitive than domestic commerce, and the tolerance under our constitutional principles for a certain amount of inequality and difference and double taxation that's acceptable in domestic commerce, that doesn't go in foreign commerce.
Well, is part of your argument here that Vermont wants to take in this dividend income, it should include in the all of the assets owned in the property factor, all of the assets owned by the subsidiaries?
It would have to use a totally different method of taxation. That given this method of tax.
But they can't have it both ways.
They can't have it both ways. And their tax, Your Honor, has to be judged by what they did. They didn't tax us as a combined company on a unitary basis. And they can't argue here, as most of their briefs argue, the jurisdiction to tax depends on being a unitary business. That just isn't the method by which they tax us.
And what's your basis for saying New York could tax it all?
That's right.
But without, would they have to treat you as a unitary company?
No. Here's what we're saying, Your Honor. What we are saying is that following the tradition in this country.
Why wouldn't you make the same argument with respect to New York if they attempted to include the dividends but not all the properties in the factor, in the allocation?
I'll tell you why we wouldn't make that argument, Your Honor. I see no difficulty with the proposition that a state may impose a tax on a holding or investment company for its activities in connection with the ownership of that stock. We're not arguing that no state may impose this tax. I see the problem of dividend income is very different from operating income. They're very different problems. And I have no difficulty with the proposition that a state, in addition to taxing operating income, may impose a tax on the privilege of engaging in business, in effect, as a holding an investment company. And that's the commercial domicile, typically. So we wouldn't argue the point you're suggesting, Your Honor. But what we are saying is that the necessity of eliminating multiple taxation with respect to foreign dividends, apart from the due process problem that a state like Vermont has no connection with this whole matter, that necessity makes it important and sound as a matter of fiscal policy, sound under the due process clause, and sound under the necessity of avoiding multiple taxation to limit this power of taxation just to the state of commercial domicile where all the activities take place. Or the business side is
and you would say that even if New York just attempted to apply its regular income tax to you.
I beg your pardon, I didn't quite get that.
You wouldn't object if New York attempted to apply a normal income tax statute to you.
Not at all.
And include the dividend income.
That's correct.
Even though they didn't purport to say this is for the privilege of doing business in New York as an investment company.
That's right. No problem with that. I think that's perfectly reasonable. Now, I want to...
Mr. Hellerstein, may I ask a question that would follow up on a question? Well, I'll raise my voice. Mr. Hellerstein, I want to follow up on a suggestion that was implicit in a question Justice Blackmun asked you. Assume there were no subsidiaries and no dividend. And with respect to your due process argument, assume that you had, say, a division that engaged in entirely separate business from the oil company. Say they made toys from the oil business. Say they made toys or sell shoes or they own an apartment building. Derive income that is clearly identifiable with a particular state other than Vermont. In your submission, could Vermont include that income as a matter of due process within the taxable base?
Mr. Hellerstein, would you like to give your answer in the microphone?
I'm sorry.
Otherwise,
my answer to
Mr. Justice must be on the recording. We'll not have.
I'm sorry.
And furthermore, I won't hear you.
Thank you very much. Now, we have similar problems.
I have no
Oh, how nice. I have the problems. Mr. Justice Stevens asked, as usual, an important question. His question was that suppose there were complete and separate business operated in some other state, would I object to the inclusion of, would I permit, and would it be permissible under my submission to include that item in the unitary business? And I said that the answer is no, it would not be, and that no state does it. Every state, in applying the unitary principle, recognizes that you cannot combine for unitary purposes two separate businesses, because there'd be income distortion. Does that answer your question, Mr. Justice Stevens?
Yes, it does.
Very good. Now, very good. I see that a lot of time at this point has expired, so I will retire. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. King?
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Vermont imposes an annual net income tax on all corporations doing business in the state. That tax is measured by that share of a corporation's federal taxable income, which is apportioned to Vermont by a standard three-factor formula. Professor Hellerstein suggests that the tax system adopted by the Vermont legislature necessarily produced the result that they seek. I suggest it did not. They arrived at that result by clearly violating the terms of the Vermont statute and not using as apportionable net income their federal taxable income, but rather using as apportionable net income federal taxable income from which they had excluded all income received in the form of dividends. As Mr. Hellerstein suggests, Mobil is a fully integrated petroleum company conducting business in part in Vermont and in part in other states of the nation. The question presented is whether the due process and commerce clauses of the Constitution required Vermont to exclude dividend income from apportionable net income. In view of Mobil's substantial business activities in Vermont, I suggest that the due process inquiry is frivolous. Mobil had the burden of proving that the dividends in question were not related to its integrated petroleum business, and therefore were not properly includable in apportionable net income. Professor Hellerstein mentions that they did seek modification of the formula. That is correct. The commissioner denied modification, and that issue has not been appealed to this court, and the modification issue is not before this court.
Mr. King, may I just ask you if you would regard as equally frivolous the position that as a matter of constitutional due process, the state would be required to exclude the toy business income if they had a separate toy business in a different state?
Yes, I would, Your Honor.
You'd say that was frivolous, too.
I would say that was a frivolous question. What Professor Hellerstein proposes there in his answer to that question is separate accounting. Separate accounting is an alternative to apportionment, but the two are not used in conjunction with each other.
Is he correct in saying that it is customary for states to segregate out, to permit a taxpayer to eliminate income from entirely separate aspects of its business which are allocable to another state, and clearly so?
That depends on the state statute, Your Honor.
I realize that, but he said that typically states do permit that. Is that your judgment?
I think that's probably correct.
And does Vermont do that?
The Vermont statute would include in the apportionable net income all federal taxable income of the corporation.
So that would take a contrary position.
It would take
that.
A contrary provision. However, Your Honor, the Vermont statute contains a clear provision that if the apportionment factors applied to all of a taxpayer's federal taxable income do not produce a result which fairly reflects the extent of business activities within the state, then the commissioner is directed to modify. This is not such a case. Mobil has admitted that the income or that its stock holdings in its operating subsidiaries and affiliates are part of its integrated worldwide petroleum business. Whether or not on different facts modification would be appropriate, I can't tell you. However, it would depend on the showing before the commissioner, much as the question of multiple taxation depends on the showing before this court.
Well, did Mobile ever claim that if you wanted to include the dividends, you must include the underlying assets in the allocation formula?
Perhaps they claimed it, but that, Your Honor, is confusing two entirely separate systems of taxation. Vermont imposes a net...
You're saying that this is an integrated business worldwide, but yet you exclude the... From the property factor, the property that's owned by the subsidiary.
There's a very good reason for that, Your Honor. We are taxing only the income of Mobil Oil Company Corporation. We are not taxing the income of Mobil's operating subsidiaries and affiliates, and there is a big difference between income and dividends. There is no necessary or direct relationship between dividends paid and property, business activity, or profits. And I suggest that point is well illustrated on the record.
Do you include in the value, in the property factor, the total, Mobil's total property, the value of the stock, of the subsidiaries?
We do not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Almost no state includes the value of intangibles. In fact, I don't believe any state includes the value of intangibles.
That's not a reason. That's just a...
Correct. May I answer that question, sir?
Let me just throw this out and answer together, because it's very closely related. Supposing the stock had not been subsidiaries, but had been stock in, say, the DuPont company or something like that, would you also include it? Dividends from that stock?
Your Honor, that situation can't come up. Well, excuse me, that could come up. It would also be included. It would be included, yes. The answer to the question of why there is no property factor for the intangible stock is twofold. One, this is a tax on net income, not a tax on the property which produces that income. I think that's a critical distinction. The second point is that historically
why do you include any property why do you have a property factor? None of this is a tax on a property, but you include some property.
The second point is that historically and conceptually, intangibles, particularly when they are held by a corporate multi-state business, are attributed to those states in which that corporation does business in the same percentages as the apportionment factors of those states. And mathematically, if you exclude the intangible property entirely, it has no effect whatsoever on the apportionment factors because it's excluded equally in all of the states, according to their apportionment factor.
But you include all of the dividends from the stock.
Correct.
Well, Vermont treat the same way? I take it your answer, Justice Stevens, would indicate yes, that the income from Mobil's domestic subsidiaries.
Income from a domestic subsidiary, Your Honor, would be consolidated under the federal system. There would be no dividends. There's a full dividend deduction.
Because Mobil has chosen to report that way?
No, because we tax based on federal taxable income, and in federal taxable income, intercorporate dividends from subsidiaries are deducted, 100%.
And how about separate businesses?
If it was a separate business, if Mobil was holding stock in DuPont, then no, then it would be included. But, Your Honor, the point raised on income from intangibles, the same point can be made with regard to patents, royalties. Professor Hellerstein has conceded that that is a portionable income. The same point can be made with any other property, tangible or intangible. The income is included and is apportionable. Mobil has the burden of proving that these stock holdings were not connected with its integrated petroleum business. Mobil has not met this burden. In fact, the only proof that Mobil has offered in response to this burden are the statements that the stock certificates are held, managed, and controlled, and the dividends are received outside Vermont. This brings up another interesting question, and that's Professor Hellerstein's commercial domicile point. I suggest that issue, is not properly before the court. There is no evidence in the record that the commercial domicile had anything whatsoever to do with Mobil's stock holdings, with the stocks themselves, or with the dividends received. Mobil has shifted position somewhat in its reply brief to say, well, it's either commercial domicile or business situs. There is no business situs which has been identified on the record. That leaves a taxpayer with this kind of a record in a position to go to each state in succession and say, they're not here. can't tax him. So I would suggest that the commercial domicile argument is entirely speculative on this record. As to the facts that Mobil's properties are held, Mobil stock holdings are held, managed, and controlled outside the state of Vermont, so are many of Mobil's other properties. And the income from all of those properties is clearly includable in apportionable net income. The whole concept of apportionment is to get away from precisely what Mobil is trying to get us into here, and that is the difficulty of ascertaining where in an integrated operation profits arise and to what particular location those profits are attributable. That simply is not a workable system, as I think this Court has recognized long ago and certainly as any scholar in the field has recognized. There is nothing in the Constitution or in the decisions of this Court which would support or imply a prohibition against apportioning among the states income from intangible property used in an integrated business activity, a part of which was conducted within the state. I made a point on dividends a little earlier in connection with a question from Mr. Justice White. At page A90 of the Consolidated Appendix, there appears a graphic illustration of what I said. In paragraph 31 there, they report a dividend paid by a company which, and I quote, had no gross income during the year 1970, the only year here at issue in which it paid dividends to Mobil. What's the relationship between the dividends and the underlying factors? None whatsoever. Mobil next argues that because its operating subsidiaries and affiliates are engaged in foreign commerce, that there is a prohibition against Mobil including the dividends paid on those stocks. Once again, a failure to focus on what the subject of the tax is. The subject of the tax is the net income. And in a very old case, Page v. Lowe, this Court very clearly focused on that distinction and said the net income is not the foreign commerce which produced that income. I think that that's a conceptual point that's exceedingly elementary and basic to this issue. There is no decision of this Court that would determine the tax consequences of income in the hands of a taxpayer on the basis of the tax attributes of the payor of that income. In this case, Mobil is receiving the income from its operating subsidiaries and affiliates, much as it would receive income from the sale of petroleum products, much as it would receive royalties from the licensing of patents. Nothing supports a tax analysis based on the characteristics or the business or the property factors of the payor. The Court's decision in Japan Line, I suggest, therefore has no application whatsoever to this case. As to Mobil's multiple taxation argument, I believe the Court clearly said in Mormon that multiple taxation must be proved to have in fact occurred. I also suggest that in the context of a tax on apportioned net income, the multiple taxation concept doesn't make any sense because when you mix taxes, for example, the type of tax Mobil argues for in its commercial domicile argument is a gross receipts tax. It says that all dividends.
Was the tax imposed in Japan Line a ad valorem property tax?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Not an income tax.
Absolutely. And the problem of multiple taxation that was raised in Japan Line was simply this. A foreign sovereign had taxed that property. The County of Los Angeles sought to impose another tax on that property. Double taxation, in fact, appeared on the record, and the Court, in, I think, a very sound rationale, said, look, we do not have the power to control the apportionment between a foreign sovereign and a United States a political subdivision. That's basic. Here, the foreign commerce multiple taxation argument that Mobil makes is that there is a risk that the states will impose multiple taxation. That's a risk over which this Court clearly has a controlling power. This Court, as it has said in several opinions, will correct errors of apportionment when they occur. Mobil's speculative argument that that multiple taxation could result from diverse state apportionment formula goes right to that point. When it does, the court clearly is authorized to make a corrective or require a corrective measure. Neither the Constitution nor any decision of this court grants to the commercial domicile of a multi-state business the power to tax without apportionment income from intangibles held in connection with that business. If that issue was ever properly raised, I suggest that this court might require apportionment, which would fairly allocate to those states in which business is conducted a share of that income. That case has not been raised on this record. That's I think, exceedingly important. Vermont is a state in which Mobil conducts substantial business activities, taxed Mobil's net income, including dividends from operating subsidiaries and affiliates, fairly apportioned to local business activities. Mobil has conceded that the apportionment factors were correctly calculated and the apportionment formula was correctly applied. On the record, the tax imposed was non-discriminatory, fairly apportioned to reflect Mobil's substantial business activities in Vermont, and fairly related to the services provided by Vermont. Mobil has failed to meet its burden of proving that its stock holdings in operating subsidiaries and affiliates were unconnected with its integrated petroleum business, a part of which was carried on in Vermont. In fact, Mobil has basically conceded that point. Mobil has also failed to meet its burden of proving that its dividends could be subjected to multiple taxation if included in the Vermont tax base. Accordingly, under the decisions of this court, particularly the Mormon, or most recently the Mormon decision, the decision of the Vermont Supreme Court should be upheld. Thank you.
Mr. Dexter.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Now, the basic issue in this case is whether certain income from intangible property, namely dividends, can be included in a state's net income tax base subject to apportionment when the taxpayer has made no showing that the intangibles were not acquired and held as an integral part of its unitary multi-state business. Now, Mobil would lead this court to believe that there is some constitutional requirement in both the Due Process and Commerce Clauses of the United States Constitution that expressly prohibits states in which that business is conducted from including such income in apportionable income for state income tax purposes. Now, Mobil initially argues that the state in which a multi-state taxpayer maintains its commercial domicile has the exclusive power to subject such income to a net income tax. Now, no decision of this court supports such an arbitrary rule. In fact, all of the apportionment decisions of this court, in the net worth cases, income tax cases, ad valorem utility property tax cases, refute this idea. Now, recognizing the weakness of the commercial domicile fiction, and we must remember it is a legal fiction, Mobil has changed this argument to include the states of either the commercial domicile or business situs of intangible properties. Now, let us examine this fictional situs in theory in the context of state income tax laws. First, we must realize that intangibles, by their very nature, have no fixed location or situs. This court was well aware of that in many domiciliary cases, and particularly in the case of Curry versus McCandless, and noted that the bundle of benefits and interests represented by intangible properties could be spread over many jurisdictions, and that any jurisdiction had the power to tax intangibles if those jurisdictions conferred benefits and privileges in regard to the ownership of such intangibles. But in the case of stock, where is it located for state income tax attribution purposes? This is the underlying question in this case, Your Honors. Is it at the legal domicile, the business headquarters or commercial domicile of the corporation? And remember, large multinational corporations may have various locations that could qualify as a commercial domicile. Or is it where the stock certificates are physically located? Is the situs where the stock would be pledged or hypothecated? Or is it where?
Yes. You're emphasizing the intangible
right.
point very properly, of course, because that's this kind of case. Would you distinguish my hypothetical case of a toy business or something else that is a separate operating business with actual tangible assets but identifiable in a state other than the taxing state?
Well, Your Honor, basically the position of the states is, and I think in conformity with the decisions of this court, that all of the unitary income of a unitary business is subject to a reasonable rule of apportionment.
My hypothesis is that it's not unitary.
Okay, your hypothesis is that it's not unitary. Under the commission's regulations, you would treat those as two separate, distinct trades or businesses, and you would tax them accordingly.
Well, I understand that's the practice. My question is, as a matter of constitutional law, would you say that the argument that is there's a due process objection to taxing that out-of-state income?
Well, it seems to me that...
You draw a distinction in terms of constitutional law. I know what the practice is.
Okay. The question is, and this is one of the fundamental questions in this case, the bottom line is the apportionment result. What income has the state attributed to it by the application of an apportionment formula to a tax base?
Well, I don't understand that you've answered my question.
Well,
my question is there a constitutional... You say there's no constitutional objection to treating intangible income as being earned in Vermont because you can't really place intangibles and it's part of the overall business always.
Okay.
My question is, assuming you have income from tangible assets, which is clearly identifiable to another state, and it's not in the unitary, in the sense we've used it in the past, part of the unitary business operated in Vermont, is there a valid constitutional objection to Vermont taxing that income?
My answer would be yes, in my judgment. But here, that is not the circumstance, you understand. We're talking about an intangible properties integrated with mobile as a single entity's unitary trade or business. It has nothing to do with combined reporting. We're saying that Vermont has a right to reasonably apportion that part of Mobil's total income from its overall operations by a reasonable attribution rule, and that Mobil has the burden of establishing that an apportionment result so applied is violative of due process because it taxes extraterritorial values or income or violates the Commerce Clause on basically the same grounds.
But, Mr. Dexter, how do you answer Mr. Justice White's question that if you want to throw the income into the pot, you must also throw the assets in?
Well, okay. The rationale of an apportionment formula is the three-factor formula that the income of a corporation, regardless of what is the nature of the property that generates this income, is attributable to where its tangible property, payrolls, and sales are attributed. Now, intangibles, by their very nature, don't have a fixed situs, so that conceptually they may be spread over the business wherever it is conducted. Now, that's basically what this court did in the Adams Express case. $15 million of intangible stocks and bonds, $5 million of tangible property. The question is, what is the value of this tangible property, going concern value in the taxing state? And this court said it was an apportionment of the entire intangible value on the basis of the physical location of the underlying property. And it seems to me that you have to do this because of the elusive nature of intangibles. And really what Mobil and Cost and NAM are saying here, because of that elusive nature, they can know that it represents a tax exemption to apply legal fictions or elusive concepts like business situs.
Well, would it make a lot of difference in a case like this if the value of the shares was included in the property factor?
The value of the shares wasn't included in the property factor?
Well, would it make a lot of difference if it was included?
Well,
yes,
but the question is, if you include it in the property factor, if you're going to include intangibles, what state do you attribute it to?
Just include it in the property and then apportion it. You just include it in the factor along like other property.
No, but you have, Your Honors, each factor you have to give it, you have to locate it for purposes of the numerator of the apportionment factor. Where do you put it in the numerator? In New York, the commercial domicile, where the business situs of the property is, or do you spread it, basically, by ignoring it, where the underlying tangible property is? And essentially, that is what is done, except when someone comes in and asks for some kind of relief.
But you are allocating, you are taking it, you are... What is the denominator in that total property?
The denominator would be total property, tangible property, over tangible property within the state.
Well, how about, why don't you include in that the value of shares owned?
Well, it's simply because the three-factor formula is limited to tangible property with the idea that intangibles have no fixed situs for... denominator purposes.
Well, you keep saying that, but I don't understand it. I don't know why not.
Well, where do you attribute? The commercial domicile, the legal domicile?
The denominator is total property, isn't it?
What?
The denominator is total property, isn't it?
No, it's total tangible property.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, that's
total,
the way the factors work now. I mean...
I know, but I'm just asking you, why not? If you're talking about the total property that... Why do you exclude the intangibles from the total property that you use in the
property? I'm saying because you don't know where to put it in the denominator. If it's used,
Mr.
basically...
Mr. the denominator doesn't have any relevance to where the property is located. That's a total.
None at all.
The only time you need to know where the property is in the numerator, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yes. The numerator over the denominator equals the fraction.
I understand, but the denominator, you don't know where 99.9% of the assets are in Vermont's denominator, do you? You just know they're not in Vermont.
Right.
All you need to know is a total figure for
that. And you're just taking in the numerator the property that's located in Vermont.
Right.
And you've said 100 times already that the intangible isn't located in Vermont. But you do know that Mobil owns it.
We do not say that it's not located in Vermont. We say that it has a business situs where Mobil carries on its underlying business.
This way, if you included in the denominator the value of the shares that Mobil owns in its subsidiary, but didn't take any part of that, didn't assign any part of that to Vermont in the numerator, it would make a difference, wouldn't it?
Well, it would make a substantial difference.
Yeah. And the state wouldn't like it.
No, I doubt it.
And I doubt if you would.
Well.
Yeah.
Very well. Mr. Hellerstein, you have about...
Mr. Chief Justice.
A little time left.
One of the cardinal principles, one of the pillars of the argument to the other side, in effect, is this. If you're dealing with apportionment, everything goes. But you don't have to have a due process connection between the items included in the apportionable base and the state. That's just not so. The cases are to the contrary. The cases have established the requirement that because a class of income, for example, goes into a base of the tax, typically, that's going to increase the tax attributable to the state. Not always, but typically so. Now, it's for that reason that the courts have held throughout that there has to be a connection between the types of income that are included and the taxing state.
Mr. Hellerstein, what about including in the denominator the value of the shares owned in the subs?
Of course, your answer, it's a really very simple proposition. Of course, if you include the intangibles, which you would have to do, it seems to me, if you're going to get to this problem of allowing apportionment of the income from the intangibles, of course they should be included in the base.
Well, they don't do it, though.
No, they don't do it. They don't include the dividends either in the receipts factor.
Yeah, but did they ever ask you, did you ever ask them to
we
include
asked for,
it in
we
the
denominator? We asked for a modification on the basis of these points, and they denied it. Now, the Adams Express case that's been cited by Mr. Dexter to the contrary has got nothing to do with this case. That was a property tax case. Of course, all the property in a business.
Well, Japan Lines was a property. Sir? Japan Line was a property tax case, and you had no intention to rely on it.
Japan Line was. Excuse me, sir. Going back a minute to Adams Express, it was a capital stock tax case. Capital stock tax measures are essentially property tax measures. Japan Line was a property tax case. Now, the point I want to make is this: that we're dealing with an income tax case here, and the fact that property was used and held to be included in Adams Express stocks and bonds, the court said they're to be included in the base. Stocks and bonds in connection with the transportation business are to be included in the base unless it's shown that they're not used in the business. We've got a totally different kind of situation. We've got an income tax, and we've shown that in the earning of this income, absolutely nothing takes place in the state of Vermont. So there's not the slightest basis for their taxing us. Now, I do want to press another point, and that is there really is an important difference between dividends and operating income for purposes of how the states divide income. The history of apportionment by formula is this. Take the typical case. You've got a company manufacturing in one state, manufactures goods in one state and sells in another. We've never been able to work out any accounting method to determine how does the net income, which comes final step on the sale of the shoes or whatever you're manufacturing, how do you determine what the legitimate claim of each of those states that's part of this that are part of this integrated operation? How do you divide it up among them? The accountants failed us. And so we developed what is admittedly a rough and crude approximation, but the best thing we know. We said we'll use a formulary method and we'll allow certain factors to determine which state has a claim. That we had to do. But dividends were traditionally not treated under the formula. Why?
When you say we, Mr. Hellerstein,
sir?
When you say we, are you talking about Mobil, or are you talking about
at this point,
the
I have associated myself with the scholars and tax people in the field for the last 30 years. It has developed.
Court decisions?
The states developed. The states developed, and all of them use an apportionment method. And when I'm saying we, I mean the community of fiscal people interested in this area.
Well, how about Moorman, where, as I recall, Iowa used only one factor?
But it was a formula. It was a formula, Your Honor. The point I'm making is this. Why did we go to the formulary method? In the Moorman case, what do you have? Manufacture of animal foods in Illinois, sale in Iowa. There's no way you can determine which piece of income without a formula, whether you like the Moorman formula or not, but they used a formula. But dividends are different, and the reason is this. Typically, stocks are handled at the executive seat of the corporation. And so that normally, is the commercial domicile where all the activities take place earning the stock. In some cases, it may have a separate business situs. And of course, we've made the contention throughout that the commercial domicile is the right rule unless you've obtained a business situs elsewhere. Now, why is that so? You don't have any problem of localizing the source of the income. You know it. It's the commercial domicile or business situs. And that's why traditionally that income was attributed there. And that's why, as a matter of fiscal policy, it should be attributed there. Why? By any precept of accepted fiscal policy, benefits, protection, costs of services, that's the state that's entitled to this income.
No, this court has never held that.
This court has never so held. State courts have so held. Lower federal courts have so held. We're asking this court so to held because it's right.
Mr. Hellerstein, what about the problem of a corporate domicile?
What about the problem? That's a very interesting question,
Delaware,
Your Honor.
Delaware and a commercial domicile
right.
in New York,
in other
and
words,
each tried to tax 100%.
Right.
What do you do there?
Your Honor, the only cases that I know of in the history of this court which have considered that question, the question I take it is this. Suppose you have a corporation organized in Delaware, and it has the usual statutory office in Delaware, but it really does its business in New York. And New York is the commercial domicile. Under this commercial domicile rule, does that deprive the state of Delaware of the power to impose this tax? The only cases I know, Your Honor, are the old cream of wheat case, I think, in the capital stock tax area, which seemed to suggest that the state of corporate domicile, because it incorporated the company, might not be deprived of its power to include all the intangibles, all the assets in its base. Subsequent opinions of this court indicated that's open to doubt. I don't know how the court would decide that. The court couldn't take one of two lines. The court could determine that the commercial domicile becoming the real seat of the corporation is a substitute for the powers of the technical corporate domicile, which I would think would be an economically and realistic rule. Or conceivably, the court could hold that both would have the power to tax in that case. But that's a question that, as far as I know, has not been decided.
What about the case in which there is a valid argument as to whether the commercial domicile is in New York, where they hold their directors' meetings and have some safety deposit boxes, or over in New Jersey, where they have their principal offices day-to-day and so forth? Can't you have a problem as to which is the right commercial domicile?
Your Honor, I have never heard of a rule of law that doesn't present problems. Of course we're going to have problems, but these are manageable problems, sensible problems, and not what you get into with a diversity of apportionment. Of course there'll be problems. But it's not beyond the wit of the tax administrators in the court to deal with them. We do it all the time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Stafford against...